Hey, this is BT Wolf, and you're listening to Orange Juice for the Ears on Dublab. And today it's my supreme pleasure to introduce someone who really needs no introduction. Susie Quattro broke barriers and rewrote the rules for women in a male-dominated rock culture. And when once asked whether women have balls, Susie, what did you say?
I said, yes, we have balls. We keep them in our head where they can't get kicked.
What a perfect line. When did you, just out of curiosity, when did that thought first occur to you?
Oh, God. As soon as I realized that there was a difference between the sexes, I guess. And I decided that I would obtain balls as well.
I think you were born with them. So, you know, you came down with them already.
Yeah, you can't develop them. You can't grow up here. They've got to be. It's an attitude, you know, it's an attitude.
So, Susie, you're a singer, songwriter, bass player, band leader, actress, radio presenter, poet. I mean, there really is only one Susie Q. And for this reason, Susie Q has quite rightfully been hailed as the first lady of rock and roll. So, Susie, thank you so, so much for joining us today. It's such a pleasure. And how have you been dealing with this lockdown?
Well, I've been just being creatively ridiculous. I've written 14 tracks for the next album with my son, and I'm still writing. I can't seem to stop writing at the moment. And, you know, you have your dry period, so when this is happening, I'm just at either the piano or the guitar all the time. I've assembled From Scratch, which comes out next month, the illustrated lyric book that I've always wanted to do. My poetry book was called Through My Eyes. It's a coffee table size. And this one's called Through My Words. And I'm working on my third book now. Plus, I've been doing the script for the movie, and the guy will be done with it mid-July 17th. He delivers the script. So I've been ridiculous busy. Plus, my bass lines on the internet, I did 50 of those. They took a lot of work. I did 10... Sunday specials. I can't not create, I guess.
And I think that is clear. You're a force of permanent creative energy. And, you know, and some people just are. It's like the time here feels limited, you know, in terms of just, well, while we're here, we have to do what we can do.
Absolutely. I use every minute. That's just me.
So we first met originally, actually pretty recently, 6 months ago or so, at the She Rock Awards. And from that night, you know, there was one person I had to connect with for some reason, and it was you. And, you know, since we met, it feels like we've known each other for much longer than 6 months.
I think we have. And it was me that came up to you. Isn't that funny? I had to tell you something, which we don't need to go into because it's private, but I came to you. I had to tell you something, didn't I?
You did.
Yeah, and I couldn't not say it, you know, so we'll leave that there. But yeah, I think we've known each other a very, 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 very long time. We're both very old souls, by the way.
Definitely. And we both have a love of Elvis. I mean, which is crazy. I didn't even realize that about you and that first track that imprinted, which we'll get to in a minute. But also just that sense of not really seeing, you know, gender and just feeling like a being, really.
Yeah, I don't know. I've just never... Everybody's always asking me, how did you feel being the only girl? And I kind of go, what? Because I just never thought of myself that way. Sure, I'm a girl, but does it matter? Does it matter? I don't think so.
No. When it's that box, it's the labels and the boxes. And I think a lot of people need to understand things through boxes and through labels. And when you don't really see that, when you see things as limitless, you know, it's very bizarre in some ways that everyone comes with these categorizations.
Yes, and that's one thing I think you'll say it yourself anyway. I'll say it for you. That comes out of the documentary. I refuse, all my life, I refuse to be categorized or boxed in. You can't do it to me. I won't let you do it to me. Because as soon as you do that, I'm going to change shape. Don't give me limits. The world is limitless. I've always said that. There's nothing you can't do if you want to do it. Except maybe pee standing up, you know?
I tried that. I tried that a few times.
That's when my balls let me down.
So the subject of this show is, you know, it's called Orange Juice for the Ears. The title is taken from a line written by Oliver Sacks about the power of music and how deep it really goes. And that line is, music can lift us out of a depression or move us to tears. It's a remedy, a tonic, an orange juice for the ear. And I just want to know, Susie, what does that quote mean to you?
It's 1,000,000% correct. Music can, God, where would it be without it? You know, there are certain songs you immediately cry to. I do. And in fact, I'm a very mood girl, so I know myself very well. And if I'm in the mood to need a good cry, I know exactly which songs to put on. If I'm in the mood to transport myself back to my youth, I know which song to put on. Whatever I need to do, I will put on that kind of music. And it's invaluable. Oh my God, what a wonderful profession I'm in. You can go out there and sing a song and people are uplifted. Jeez. Wow. And sometimes I can't believe they pay me for it, you know? I've said it many times. I'm up there doing a show, maybe 10,000 people, and I go, you're paying me to do this? Are you crazy? You know, because I love entertaining people. I love making people happy.
When also something you said, which really, really sort of stuck out, is you're an entertainer, but you're also a communicator, really.
Yes. Yeah, this is why, Beanie, this is why I do. I'm not being greedy. I just like to communicate in whichever avenue is presented to me. So if it's an acting role, great, I'm going to communicate that role. If it's my poetry, communicate that way. If I'm on stage, I communicate that way. If I'm doing a DJ, like I did for 15 years on BBC Radio 2, I'm communicating that way. I need to reach out to people pretty much all the time. And that's what I'm like.
So going back to little Susie, and you know, the subject of this show, what was the first song that imprinted on you?
The first moment for me was, it actually affected my entire life. This one pivotal moment, my entire life, I've carried this on my shoulder. I was 5 and a half, not 6 yet. I think it was December, January, I even looked up the date, and we were all watching the Ed Sullivan Show, which was essential viewing for all American families. Came out at 8 o'clock, variety show, and at the end of the show, he would always say, and now something for the youngsters, and he would play one of the, either whatever it was in rockabilly, rock, whatever, you know, one of these upcoming singers, bands, whatever, and he brought on Elvis Presley. And my sister was one of my sisters, 9 years older. And she started to scream because I was five, she was like 14, 15. And I'm looking at her thinking, why are you screaming? I didn't get it. I was only a little girl. And then I went into the camera and I went into the show and Elvis drew me in like a magnet. He was doing Don't Be Cruel. And I was hypnotized. And he went, and I was gone. And in my head at that age, I said, I am going to do that. That's a true story. I didn't embellish that. I had my light bulb moment at that age.
Okay, well, after that perfect description, I feel like I'm there with you. Let's have a listen to Don't Be Cruel by Elvis Presley.
I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true.
And that was Don't Be Cruel by Elvis Presley. And you're listening to Susie Quattro's Orange Juice for the Ears. And you first heard that, Susie, when you were 5 and a half. And you remember the date. And your sister initially was the one who was kind of first responding. And so what was that, you know, after that moment of sort of seeing what you were then going to do really clearly, you know, just take us back to that living room. How did that play out afterwards? Did your family come in or?
No, they did. I was on my own with that thought. But it brought me into that rock and roll thing, you know. And then I used to sneak and listen to my sister playing her records. I used to sneak, listen to my older brother playing his records. Always on my mind, this rock and roll music. I used to go down in the basement and take a broomstick and put rubber bands all the way up and down it and pretend to pluck the bass. Unbelievable. I took up bongo drums because I wanted to be a beatnik too. You know, I did that too. And I used to cut white straws into cigarette sized pieces and put baby powder up there so it looked like I was smoking. You don't want to know all this. And the funny thing about that though is it never ever occurred to me for a millisecond, even while I was growing up with Elvis firmly in my mind, that he was a guy and I was a girl. That didn't go through my head. You know, it's crazy when you think of it. And then I remember one time, I forget what year this was. It must have been when I was 8 or 9, I think. And my father came home from work. Another cement, you know, in my head and my heart. And he, you know, he's tired and he took his coat off and he had a single in his hand that obviously he had purchased. They were plastic big ones, you know, whatever you call them. And I think they played at 33 and a third. Anyway, he walked in, you know, put his coat on the hook, took his shoes off, just back from work, and he threw this record on the dining room table. He just went, like with an attitude. And he looked at me, I happened to be standing there. He said, okay, so the kid can sing. It was Love Me Tender by Elvis Presley.
So your dad initially wasn't an Elvis fan.
He wasn't. By doing that, he was saying he was. Okay, he can sing. You know, so he was saying it in his way. Okay, you know. Because that song, he sings beautifully. And then we fast forward there to, you know, all my music lessons. I took classical piano. I played quite good piano. I took percussion. I was first chair in the percussion section at school, beating all the guys. did I like that? Oh, yeah. So then we started again after watching the Ed Sullivan Show. It's so strange how these things kept repeating. It was 1964, and at the end of the show this time, he brought on the Beatles, and they were doing, I saw her standing there. I remember that. And we ran to the phone as soon as that performance is over. One of my sisters and me, the elder one, Patty, and we called these other two sisters who we knew, Nan and Mary Lou Ball. And then we got on the other phone. Everybody had an extension. We got on the phone with a girl that lived 5 doors down, and her dad was in my dad's group, his band. So it's all connected. And we all were screaming, you know, did you see the Beatles? Da 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 da, that hair, la da 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 da. And somebody said, I think it might have been Patty, she said, why don't we form an all-girl band? Oh, yes. And then everybody spoke at once. It was so strange. Everybody spoke. And I'm usually real quick to talk, but for some reason, I didn't talk. And then everybody was choosing an instrument. And finally, I said, hello, what about me? And my sister Patty said, you're going to play bass. And I said, okay, but I didn't care. It didn't matter that I already played, you know, percussion and piano, and it just didn't matter. And I went to my dad and asked him, because he was a musician, and we had something of everything in the house. We had two pianos, full pianos. We had an accordion, two accordions, one which is a French scale. We had a mandolin, a banjo, ukulele, and a harp. And I said, do you have a bass? And he said, sure. So we're starting a band. So he gave me, for my first bass, which I make musicians green when I tell them this, he gave me a 1957 Fender Precision for my first bass.
Wow.
Excuse me. Honest to God, I didn't know it was a big bass. I just thought this is, I honestly didn't. I didn't even consider a small one because I asked him if he had a bass and this is what he gave me. So this is what I learned, you know, and I can't play a small bass. It feels like a toy to me. And yes, it's nearly as tall as me, but I never noticed it. Just like I don't do gender. I don't do size either. I think I'm 6 foot two.
I think you're even bigger than that. But just to paint the picture, because, you know, and that's all so fascinating, and what an incredibly rich sort of musical environment it sounds like you were in just from, you know, very young, or your whole life. But you were born in Detroit. You had an American dad, Hungarian mom, four sisters and a brother, and some adopted siblings as well. So that family life was obviously something, particularly with, you know, playing in your dad's band and then having this band with your sisters. You know, were you conscious then that you might end up going off and doing your own thing?
Yes, is the honest answer. How do you say it? I'm not going to beat around the bush, okay? Because I can't do it anyway. I knew that I was different. Can we put it that way? I knew I was the square peg in the round hole. I didn't quite fit. Some reason, I didn't quite fit. And I also found out very young, just by doing the family shows and everybody doing their little, you know, party piece, that I had the ability to hold the audience. I would notice whenever I did my little piece that the whole room would go quiet and everybody would watch me. So even very young, I knew I could entertain people. You see, I knew it. And I always felt, right from when I was tiny, that someday somebody was going to come up and tap me on the shoulder and say, come on, come with me, I'm going to make you a star. And I was waiting for it my whole life. Nothing nasty in that, just I always thought it was going to happen. So when it did, I went. Because what choice do you have? Yeah, I knew my path for my whole life. Really, I knew my path.
From seeing Elvis, age 5 and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I knew where I was going. And my mother, she used to complain sometimes when I got much older. And we used to talk about that in my childhood. And she used to say, she said it a lot. She said, I shouldn't have let you go in that damn, and she never swore, that damn rock and roll band so young. You were so young. And she said it so many times. And finally, I said to her, why didn't you just say no? And she said, it became a song. She said, because, Susie, sometimes love is letting go. It's one of the nicest songs I've ever written. And it closed my one-woman show on Zip that I did on the stage. I never forget that when she said that. It was just before she passed away. Her last trip here. Sometimes love is letting go. She said, you were going to do it anyway. You were going where you were going from so young. You were going there. So my mother even knew it, you know.
That's beautiful.
It is.
Okay, and now it is time for your second choice. What was the first album that really shaped who you are and had a big impact?
Well, this is without a doubt, and I have to tell a tiny little bit of a story. There's a club in Detroit called The Chessmate, and we went to see a group out of New York. They were a psychedelic group called the Blues Magoos. They had one hit called You Ain't Got Nothing Yet, You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, something like that. Anyway, I've never seen a band right here in my face that, you know, the sound was so much it made you wave, you know, and they were psychedelic. And I was like, wow, it was my first psychedelic experience. And I was a 60s teenager. And then we ended up partying with them a little bit. I was only 14, and the guy was 18. But I ended up talking to the bass player. I ended up in his room somehow. And I always remember it. I don't know if you can tell this on show, but it's funny. He said to me, have you ever smoked pot? And me being me, sure. I'd never done it in my life. So he gave me a joint. And me being me, I went, oh, it's nothing. Give me another one. So he gave me another one. So this is a 14-year-old who's never done anything. So all of a sudden, I was high, and I didn't know how to deal with it. And he said to me, he was very kind. He didn't do anything wrong. He knew I was underage. But he said, do you know Bob Dylan? And I said, no. And he said, I'm going to play you an album. So he played me Blonde on Blonde. And the song Stuck Inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again. I have never heard anything like it before in my life. I'm a Dylan fanatic, by the way. I'm anal about him. I will quote you lyrics. I'll make you sit next to me and I'll quote you lyrics. But he says, oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck here inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again. You see how much I listen? And I've never known anybody who can say, oh, mama, so many different ways. And you get hooked on it, you know? And I'm still when I sit outside now, I still play Dylan nonstop. He's another Gemini like me, and he taught me the value in that one song of a lyric. And he has the ability to make me cry. I cry over Blown in the Wind. I cry over that lyric. I don't know if anybody else does. I do. I cry over Lay Lady Lay. I cry over Just Like a Woman. In fact, I did a wonderful version of that on my Quattro Scott and Powell album. One of the best vocals I ever did because I love the song so much. Anyway, I love this track. You might not be able to play it all, but it's Dylan at his best. It is my favorite Dylan album.
Okay, perfect. So on that note, we're going to take a listen to Stuck Inside, a Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again by Bob Dylan off the album Blonde on Blonde.
Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Grandpa died last week, and now he's buried in the rocks. But everybody's still talking.
That was Stuck Inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again by Bob Dylan off the record Blonde on Blonde, which was Suzy Quatro's choice for the album that shaped who she is and had a big impact. So what brought you to the UK in 1971, having had this sort of sense that you were just waiting to be, you know, picked up isn't the right word, that sounds kind of somehow inappropriate, but you know, you knew what was going to happen, you were just waiting to be taken on that path that you already saw, you know, before you.
I had been in the band The Pleasure Seekers. We were kind of a show band. I'm going to give you a potted history. So we did, you know, we were a girl band and we wore the mini skirts and did the show numbers and did the clubs and all that. We were always working. And I always, even with the mini skirt on, I always had to be different. I'd wear a top hat. You know, I'd do something to look so stupid. Anyway, so this band lasted up until 1969-ish, 8-ish, 8-9. And we then did a festival with this show band in Detroit. And it was one of my brother's shows. And we died a death. We really did, because the world had moved on. As we were in that false world of clubs doing covers, the world had got heavy and you had your Led Zeppelins and your jamming and your this and that. So we did our normal show and we died a death. And it was decided that we would change the band around. My little sister would come in, sing lead. And she had a good voice. She had more of that Led Zeppelin-y type voice. I didn't. I'm what I am. And it was decided I would take a little bit of a back seat, which is okay. And I became really good on my bass in that 18 months that Cradle existed. And we wrote our own songs and everything, but I didn't like the band very much at all. It just wasn't a happy band for me. But Elektra Records came to see that band. Me at the back, I came up and sang two songs. Okay, I'm at the back playing bass, two songs, back I went. Jack Holtzman said, I want that girl. I don't like the band at all. I want that girl, Susie, whatever her name is there, pointed to me. That same week, Mickey Most came to Detroit with Jeff Beck. My brother got him to see the band. Again, he said, I don't like the band at all. I did two songs. I like her, and I did an Elvis song, by the way. So I didn't know about it until about 3 months later, when the band was starting to break up. And in that time, I had been sending Cradle tapes, which was the name of the band, to Mickey, because everybody came and said, oh, he likes you, you know, send him some tapes. I had no idea. And then the band was kind of dispersing. And I wrote to my eldest sister again, Arlene, the one that was screaming at Elvis. And I said, I think the band's breaking up. What am I going to do? Da, 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 da. I had to try to figure out my next move. And she said, call Mickey Most. And I said, why? I've been sending him stuff and everything. Why should I call him? She said, because he only wanted you in the first place. That's the first time I heard of it. And then she said, and by the way, Elektra Records wanted you too. I went, what? So I had no idea. Anyway, Jack Holtzman made me the offer to go to New York and get a guy band and become the new Janis Joplin. And Mickey Most said, come to England and I'll make you into the first Suzy Quatro. No-brainer, right?
Oh, yeah, I mean. And did you know what Suzi Quatro was at that point, you know, in terms of the full realization?
I knew what she wasn't. In fact, I have to say, yes, I did, because even in The Pleasure Seekers, I did all the hard rocking numbers. You know, I wasn't a ballad girl. I was on there doing all the crazy dances. So, yeah, I was always that way. I always had a penchant for the 50s style rock and roll. I actually said to Mickey when I first got to England, I want the drummer on 1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock. Because it's got that nice, he's got that nice laid-back feel where he's almost falling off the drum kit. So, yeah, I kind of did know who I was. We hadn't put it in the right frame yet. But, yes, I knew I didn't fit there. I knew I was more than a bass player with my little sister singing Led Zeppelin copy songs. You know, this is not who I was. I was an entertainer. And by the time I got to England, having that training in the Pleasure Seekers, where I was the front person completely, then going back and just playing the bass for 18 months, then the two merged and became Suzi Quatro.
And there's something amazing about you, just in terms of sort of both watching you but also talking to you and hearing about it, where it sounds like you never had any sort of sense of holding back. You know, there are some people that kind of are performers but also have that very introverted side, or, you know, get a bit uncomfortable in the light, spotlight, and it's like...
No! Sorry, that doesn't compute. I feel at home. I feel like this is what the God put me down on this earth for, was to entertain people and share and uplift. So when I get on that stage, I'm actually in my spiritual home, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so then on, you know, on the image side, you know, it's that thing that I find amazing, which is, you know, why is it that the guys could be cool? You know, they could have this swagger, they could have this energy, and then somehow you had that disconnect when it came to women, and they had to be, you know, pretty or peppy or whatever it was, but just that swagger, you know, was that something that, in terms of the image you ended up, you know, that was really your image? Did you always know that, or did you kind of try out different styles and then get to...
No, Beattie. That one word that you just said, I'd say I was born with swagger, and I always had attitude. That's how it is. I never thought about it. You know, I was more tomboy. You know, I'm still the same now. Mickey always said that to me all the time when we used to talk in the early days. He'd say, "You're unique. You're unique." That's all I ever heard. You're unique. So I guess I just skirted that ground, you know. I don't do gender. That's the only way I can explain it.
Yeah. I completely understand.
You know, nobody said to me, I can explain it better this way. I'm out there doing what I'm doing and, you know, can the can. And nobody said to me, hold the bass like this, move like this, sing like this, look like it. Nobody told me to do these things. And I didn't copy anybody, although Elvis went into me. I'm not a copy of him. So I just had that swagger. I guess I was born with it.
I completely understand, and I know exactly what you're talking about. But to have someone at that point in time that was not going to be molded in any way, you know, someone that was really out there doing it their way, and, you know, there wasn't a sort of, okay, fine, I'll do one shoot like this, or, you know, whatever it is, you would just, yeah. you weren't going to be molded.
No. In fact, Mickey most often used to say, I was very close to them, he used to say, nobody tells Suzi what to do. You may suggest. I'm really proud of that, actually. And my husband once said to me, I've been with him 27 years now, we're having some kind of an argument or something, and I said, you can't live long enough to control me. And his reply was, yes, I can. I just have to be very clever. So, okay, you're going to have to work for it, you know. That's funny. So, yeah, I always have had an innate sense, you know, and that moment, that pivotal moment you know, I went on the road, I got an English band, finally got a band, went on the road, supported Slade and Thin Lizzy, got my sound together, doing all original material. The band was coming together. I was happy. Chin and Tappan were brought in, and they heard the whole set, and they, and it was all boogie, very much Can the Can. And they went away, wrote the 3-minute song. And, Mickey heard the record and he said, this is going to be a number one. He was right. It was. And then we talked about image, and there was no choice for me. It was non-negotiable. I said, I'm going to wear leather. And I insisted. And Mickey was kind of against it because he said it was old fashioned, been done in the 50s and da, 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 da. And I said, no, Mickey, I said, I want to wear leather. And he finally gave in, and he was very quiet for a minute. He was thinking, and then he said, what about a jumpsuit? And I said, okay, I can be quite naive about things, you know, and since I don't play the gender card and I don't play the sex card as such, I didn't realize even that it was going to be a sexy outfit until I put it on. And then I went, oh, my God. I did. I had no idea. But I remember the moment. I talk about it in the film. I never forget it. And that we had that first photo session, and the record was playing in the background, you know, Can the Can, you know, and I had my first jumpsuit on, snakeskin boots. And the boys were all on the ground around me, like collapsed, like I'd beaten them all up. And I say it, and I've done this in my one woman show too. It was what a moment. Because the photographer's there, Gerard Makeff, is one of the top in the business. He's done everybody. And he said, give me that Suzy Quatro look. And I had one. Do you get that? All of a sudden, I had one.
Yeah.
I went, all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, everything I'd done up to that moment, they just went like this. They all fit together, and I went, boom. There she was. That was the girl that was always there. And that was the girl that was going to run the rest of my life, you know?
So, Suzy, tell me about turning down a meeting with Elvis in 74.
Everybody has that. I was in Memphis. It was 1974. I was on my first tour there after having some hits all from the rest of the world. All Shook Up was in the lower end of the charts. It did make the charts, my version, first album. And I was in the hotel room and the phone rang. And it was Elvis's people. So I just kind of went, mouth hanging open. And then he got on the phone. And what a surreal moment. And, he, you know, it's Elvis. He said, I've heard your version of All Shook Up, and I think it's the best since my own. So I'm dying on the phone. And he said, would you like to come to Graceland? And I went, no, thank you. I'm very busy. And I did it because I wasn't, not nervous. I wasn't ready to meet him yet. I wanted to have maybe a few more hits. I wanted to be more on the level. So I didn't have to do that when I met him. You do it anyway, you know. But and I didn't know he was going to pass away. But there are so many Elvis things through my life. I, you know, when I did my one-woman show, I think there was about 9 of them. I couldn't even do them all. Where he has made an appearance over and over and over again. Even when I got my role on Happy Days, I flew over from Japan to Los Angeles. They asked me to fly over and audition for the show. I didn't know what the show was, so I did. And I wore my own leathers because I had street leathers and stage leathers. I love leather. And I walked onto the set, and the producer, Gary Masha, came up and he said, how clever of you to dress in the part. You know, I said, what the hell are you talking about? He said, oh, she's called Leather Tuscadero. I kind of went, oh, anyway, long story short. They said, okay, I met the producer, met the fans, met the director. Go back to your hotel room. We'll give you a call. So I'm waiting for the phone to ring. I turned on the TV, waiting for the phone to ring. The phone rings. I picked it up. They said, hello, congratulations. You got the role. We don't just want you for 2. We want you for 15. So you're going to have to come down and get a contract. And I was all excited. The TV came on at that point, right at that point as I'm taking the phone call. So happy. And it went, newsflash, the king is dead.
Wow.
You can't write this stuff.
No.
You can't write it. Then... And my mother always used to call me Elvis when I was young. When I was coming back about 3 months later to do the first 2 episodes, they brought in a guy and they said, this man here is going to be making your costumes for the show. Okay? I said, okay, how do you do? He was Nudie, Elvis's personal tailor.
Oh, my God.
Excuse me. He's just on my shoulder all the time. He's here all the time. And you must, when you get a chance, Google Singing with Angels. I wrote that in tribute. And if I'd met Elvis, that song would not exist, and it has to exist. Their Elvis impersonators now do it. It's played at funerals. It's a cult hit. And I recorded it with James Burton, his guitar player, and the original Jordan Ayers, minus one, who wasn't there anymore, in Nashville in his studio. So that was my path.
Incredible. And it's that sense of sometimes having to zoom out to see how everything is connected, you know, particularly when you're following your vision, your instincts, your intuition. It's just amazing. So I guess there's no part of you that wishes on that phone call.
No, there's not. And in fact, I don't do regrets. It's one of my mantras, because even the bad stuff teaches you something, and it's all meant to happen. The only regret I do have, and I'll say very quickly, is when my mother was finally passing away and my sister called me. I'd been back and forth across the pond at least 6 times, even going straight from her bedside to a gig. So I'd done my bit, and she said, "Oh my God, you remember the last time you saw her? And you thought she looked really bad. Well, she looked healthy then." I'm going, "Oh Christ almighty." So she said, "You better come over." And Mickey Mouse said to me, "Don't go. Don't go, Susie. You can't handle it." So I didn't go. And I spoke to her all the time, and she seemed to be okay with it. But I kind of wish I had. That's probably my only regret. I wish I had gone. But I do have the nicer memory of her. But, you know, I didn't go.
And just, you know, you're talking about Happy Days and Leather Tuscadero, which, you know, it's like a whole other career in some ways. Did that feel as natural to you as getting on stage for a concert?
Sure, you get nervous on the first time when you're walking out to the audience, okay, and you have never acted before. But to be quite honest, I just took to it like a duck to water. And in fact, I checked my memory of it. I was talking to Ron Howard not that long ago, and I said to him, "I'm curious." I said, "You know, did it ever feel to you like I was a new, green, brand new to the show actress?" He said, "No, it just felt like you had always been there." So he sort of confirmed what I felt, that I just was always there. So I don't know why that is. I knew I always knew I could act anyway. And I don't act, by the way, I become.
Well, and also, I think it's that sense of like being a renaissance, however it's pronounced. You know, when you're that kind of artist, you just see creativity and storytelling as, you know, well, whatever the outlet, it's the same thing. So it's not really any difference. In the same way that the boxes and the labels don't apply, also creativity and being an artist is limitless.
Correct. There's a instinct that I perform from, there's an instinct that I create from, and that instinct remains the same no matter which genre I'm doing in this wonderful business that I'm in, you know? It's always the same. My channels are always open, it gets noisy up there sometimes, but I tune in, and I tune in, it comes in, and then I give it out. That's my job.
So tell me now, in 1989, you're one of the first rock and roll acts to play Russia, 500,000 people. What was that like at that time?
Well, I took the kids. My husband, my ex-husband, didn't want me to, but I said, "I'm not going for 3 months and leaving the kids home." So they came with this. Glasnost was just beginning. So we saw the Russia trying to be the new Russia. I'll never forget it as long as I live, that tour. It really affected me. It's too long to go into. It just really affected me so much so that when I got home after 3 months being there, I walked into my home here, this beautiful home I live in, and I said to my ex, "This is decadent. What are we doing in a house like this?" Oh, jeez.
But you still have that house. Even though you said it was decadent, you do still have that house, right?
I lived here since 1980. This house drew me to it. It's amazing, this house. You'd love it. You would love it. There's plenty of energies here, plenty of spirits, all friendly. I'm supposed to be here. It's Elizabethan Manor House, finished in 1590. So you're never alone, you know.
And just before we move on to the music you're going to send into space, a question about you that is, you know, really interesting is obviously you're so embracing of this, like Susie, entertainer, communicator, you know, not holding back in any way. But you're also very grounded and you're very down to earth and you're very humble. And is that in part because you have what you call the ego room in your house that you keep things in check?
I do. I always talk about that. I think everybody should have one. I do have my feet on the ground and I am humble and I do have the ego room. And you have to go up 2 flights of stairs to get to it. It's on the 3rd floor. You can bang your head. You can trip. You can fall. It's an analogy, but it's a true analogy. If that's not a double negative. Anyway, you finally get to this big wooden door, and it's a very heavy, heavy wooden door. And on the door, I had printed a plaque, a big brass plaque, and it says, "Ego Room, mind your head." So you go in, and you see the big red book on the table. This is your life. All my guitars, some of my favorite basses, all my suits, hanging up jackets, suits, jumpsuits, everything. There's videotapes, CDs, scrapbooks, tons and tons of stage passes, hats, merchandise, pictures on every single surface. And you go up there, and it's the quietest room in the house, funny enough, that the ego room is the quietest room. Isn't that funny? And when you're done in that room, you come out and you shut the door. And that's how I live my life. You shut the door.
And now I have to ask, what is the music you would send into space?
Now, is this my Nat King Cole one?
This is your Beethoven.
Oh, my Beethoven. Oh, you just said it. I forgot. See, I don't have a list in front of me. Okay, Beethoven. And I don't know how you pronounce it. Is it pronounced Pathique, I think? Pathique. I think that's how you do it. I did study classical piano, and I play quite well. I've got my books here, and I still play. And I think Beethoven is the best because he's the most accessible. So, you know, when he played a melody, you remembered it, you know. And I love him that he was kind of crazy, and even in the middle of his beautiful pieces, he would go into this crazy bit and then come back, you know. Oh, it's okay, I'm back normal now. And that is my favorite Beethoven piece. It's just beautiful. I could listen to it not stop and never get tired of it. So yes, that should go into space. And if an alien hears that, they're bound to think, well, we're something.
Well, and who knows? Beethoven was probably an alien.
Probably one of them, yeah. Like Einstein, you know.
So now we're going to take a listen to Beethoven's Pathétique. That was Beethoven's Pathétique, and that was the music that Suzy Quatro would like to send into space. And is there also a sentiment that you'd like to send into space?
God. Well, the word that came to mind immediately was embrace. I don't know why. Embrace.
Perfect. So tell me about Suzy Q, the movie, which came out last year. How do you feel in terms of, well, firstly, it must always be incredibly strange seeing your life on the big screen. But do you feel that it captured you truthfully? And was there anything that you felt was really left out?
I think it was a fabulous documentary. I'm very happy with it. It captured me totally truthfully. It's what I wanted it to do. I insisted that it be warts and all. I insisted to the director, even if it's cringe, even if I'm cringing and I'm uncomfortable, if it's true and it's important to the story, it stays in there. So absolutely, he did a fabulous job. I couldn't be happier.
And, you know, when you see like your own movie, obviously there's also the sense of, well, we have limited time here. And you know, we've moved to the sad part of the show, which is imagining a world without Suzy Q. So on that note, have you thought about the song that you would like to have play at your memorial?
Yeah, sure. It's been in my will as long as I've had a will. When I Fall in Love by Nat King Cole. Just simply because you can go through your entire life with that song, from A to Z.
So now we're going to take a listen to When I Fall in Love by Nat King Cole.
And the moment I can feel that you feel that way too. Is when I fall in love with you.
That was When I Fall in Love by Nat King Cole, and that was the song that Susie Quattro would like to have play at her memorial. And it's that is written into your will, is that correct?
In the will, yep.
When did you write that in?
Oh, God, a long time ago. I always said it. You know, every big moment in my life, if I need to just reflect and feel and get a few tearful and go through this thing and that thing, and that's the song I do try. I don't know why. It's such a wonderful sentiment. When I fall in love, it'll be forever, you know, or I'll never fall in love. Oh, gets me every time.
And particularly, you know, Nat's version of it?
He does it like nobody else. Nobody can croon like Nat King Cole. He goes straight to the heart.
So when we were last having a chat, you were telling me about your grave project, which sounds very ominous. So do you know what you're going to have? Well, it's a silly question. What is going to be written on your tombstone, Susie?
Okay, I'm going to have two because I'm Gemini, but... This and I'm allowed, and it's my book anyway. I am doing it now. I'm doing it now. So I'm only going to give you one. I've got a lot of famous quotes. Did I get yours yet?
I'm sending it to you after this.
You better. Okay, you better. Okay, so mine is going to be two sides. The first side's going to say, now I get it. The second side's going to say, too many dreams, too little time.
Oh, it's lovely. That's really lovely. And also sort of, yeah, very reflective of two outlooks.
Yes.
So with that all in mind, is legacy something that's always been important to you?
Yes, and I have left behind a hell of a legacy. I like to think I made a difference. I like to think I made a lot of people happy. I gave a lot of myself. I didn't take anything back. Yes, I like to think I was loved.
I think that's a bit of an understatement because you did genuinely change the course of the history of rock and roll. You know, and sometimes, unfortunately, when I say unfortunately, it's not like that's a negative thing, but, you know, the cross to bear sometimes is when you're a pioneer, you know, it's like the world has to catch up with you. But, you know, you think of all the people, all the artists that wouldn't have existed without you doing what you did and what you are doing.
Well, just before we close, because I know that we're coming to the close now, I will say one thing, Beatty, and it only dawned on me after I made this documentary. So this is hindsight. Cherie Curry gave me an award at Shivak's ceremony in January. And when she got up, you know, you were there, when she got up to make the speech, she cried. Recently, I was doing an interview with her and Kathy Valentine. We're on Zoom. Kathy starts to cry. Another friend of mine from the Baby Animals, Susie DeMarchi. She ended up coming here. We worked together in Australia many times. She ended up coming, spending the night. I took her up in the Eagle Room. She started to cry.